Good morning, everybody. Charlie Harari, Book of Life, 9 a.m. Thursday morning. It is such a pleasure to be back. I can't believe another week has gone by. We're recording live from the beautiful city of Manhattan, New York City, Lower East Side. It's a gorgeous day, freezing cold, but that's sort of what we've been getting this winter. It's almost summer, almost there. But we're here, beautiful city here, and it's a beautiful day, and it's great to be back. And so we have a great show for you today. Something interesting, this is sort of this period of time where we're sort of inching towards the end of January. Another month has gone by in the new secular year, and for those that have taken on all these New Year's resolutions, this is about the time in which we start realizing, like, oh my gosh, like, I'm not doing it. Like, the resolution is sort of at the end. You know, January 1 is the beginning of the resolution, and February 1 is sort of the end of the resolution. And so this is really the time to sort of sit back and sort of rethink about what we wanted to accomplish this year and what sort of got lost throughout the month. And what I wanted to do is, this is sort of the season where the world is sort of clamoring around maybe the greatest game that is played all year, the Super Bowl. This is sort of the time where sports fans and non-sports fans all sort of come together to just sort of celebrate this athleticism, celebrate this sports, and watching the game, and or at least following it and just hearing about it. It's just a sort of an interesting craze more than any other game that goes on. It goes on in the Super Bowl. And I thought to myself, you know, this is something that is so different from what we usually talk about. Physical strength, athleticism, all that stuff is uniquely different from one of the things that we usually discuss on the show. I mean, we discuss things that are more spiritual, that are more emotional, that are more mental. The idea being that the highest form of one's life is really in their mind. It's in their emotions, in their soul. It's not in their body. And that's sort of a sense that people have, a sense that it's, you know, there's sort of something a little lower about your body, that it doesn't deserve the attention that your mind and soul has. And I was talking to someone recently about this. And what I was saying is that some of the education that I got was different. You know, a lot of people sort of feel that, like, if you're working and you're going and you're coming, whatever it is, that sort of the last thing on your list that you have to worry about is your physical strength. Is your body, is your physical power, because that's sort of less than the other stuff. That's not really true, because in truth, there's no area of your life that's less. If you have it, our job is to grow it. If it's been given to me, my job is to make it great. If God gave me a horse, my job is to make it a race horse, not an old, sluggish, obese horse. And our job in life is to be able to take areas of our lives and to refine them and to revise them and to enhance them and to connect them to the all other areas of our lives, to not separate them. Our body and our soul are not two distinct entities. They are one. They're connected for a greater purpose. Our mind, our careers, our relationships, our spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical health are not separate buckets. It's all one holistic package called us. And if we have it, we have to grow it. We have to build it. We have to make sure that when we're done with it, we've used it and utilized it to the best of its ability. As one person said, that I've got a lot of a friend of mine who said this to me. I was asking why he was so concerned about his physical health. He diets, he eats healthy, he goes to the gym. And I said, what's going on here? And he said to me, so interesting. He goes, I have so much to do in life. My body needs to get on page with that. I can't get slowed down by my body. My body needs to understand that we've got what to do, and we got to make sure we can do it. And this concept of physical strength is an interesting concept. And so in this spirit, so to speak, of the week of the Super Bowl, when these issues are just being discussed, I figured what better than to bring somebody on who has excelled and who has been a model for being able to fuse purpose, mission with physical strength and conditioning. An individual who served in not one but two armies, two of the greatest armies alive today. The Israeli Defense Forces and the U.S. Army. An individual who spends a large part of his time training people into how to be stronger, physically, mentally, how to respond to challenges. You know, we're living in a little bit of a scary time. For those of you who aren't paying attention, there's this weird, crazy, insane game called the knockout game, which is just ridiculous. But it's out there that people walk around the streets and they play a game, which is, can I knock somebody out? And they walk into regular people and they hurt them. Everyone's wonderful. God bless humanity. But there are certain people that are not at the place where they recognize that they are God-given soul and they shouldn't be hurting other people. We live in a world that we would love to say is totally perfect and fine physically, but it's not. There's a world out there where some people are looking to hurt others. And I don't mean to scare anybody, but that's just the reality that we live in. And our ability to respond to that with strength, with courage, is much different than if we look at it and go, oh my God, I hope it's not me, with fear and intimidation. That's a stance that we take in life, in everything in life. Do we lean into our problems or do we flinch? If I've got a tough relationship, do I lean in and fix it? Or do I flinch because somebody rubs me the wrong way? If I messed up a client or not doing great at work, or I got downsized and I got to start on my own, do I lean in and approach it with confidence? Or do I flinch and say, oh my gosh, I am so scared. I hope it's not me. If God throws us a challenge, do we swing at the ball or do we wait for it to go past us? It's a stance that we all take in life. And so speaking and bringing on a commando, we're going to be able to get some amazing insight as to what our stance is in life for all of our problems, for all of our challenges, for all of our fears, but in particular, a stance that we all, I think, should take in terms of how we deal with our physical bodies and our physical senses. It is my pleasure to introduce on the show Alon Evan Esh. Alon, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. Thank you.
So I want to sort of jump right in. You grew up in, you said you were born in Israel, you lived in America, and your background sort of in Judaism was sort of less than inspiring. So at some point you said, I need to connect to something more, and you joined the Israeli army.
Right, right. I grew up Reform in Edison, New Jersey. And after doing a year of college, freshman year at the time, was a completely empty, empty experience. I grew up Reform. The Reform version, in my humble opinion, of Judaism is not inspiring at all, kind of off track. So the most inspiring thing that I had, coming from Israeli parents, both of my father and my mother served in the military in a number of wars. The most inspiring thing I had at that time was to go to Israel and do something bigger than myself, was to serve, protect the country.
Mm-hmm. So what's interesting right away off the bat is that there is this sense that people feel when you live a life that is, now, I'm sure you said you were in college. I'm sure you were popular. You had stuff going on for you. You had a career. You had a trajectory in life, right? It was right. This sense that we're all going somewhere, but if what we're doing is sort of self-focused, no matter what's going on, it feels a little empty. Our inability to connect to something more sort of leaves us with that. And you got that when you went to the military. And when you got to the military, how did you decide, where did you end up?
Okay. So, going to the military, from growing up fairly athletic, playing sports all my life, I wanted to get into the most combat-oriented group that I could. So I made it into a unit called Dubdovan, also called Unit 217, 217. And to get into that unit, you have to go through something called a gibush, where you're together with a group of guys, and they see how good you are in a stressful situation. They test not only how physically strong you are, but how well you work with others.
So give us an example. What are some of the stress-related things they put you through?
So first of all, it's constant physical stress. So it's incredibly hot over there at times in Israel. During that time of the year, it was incredibly hot. They have you running up and down hills, carrying stretchers full of sandbags. And the people that you're with are dropping. They're dropping off one by one. And you depend on these people. So you have a choice, either help them out or let them go and take on their load. And it's a fine line. And it just goes on and on from there. It's just constant pressure, physical and mental.
So what's going on? Because this is something that, we had a show a couple of weeks ago about stress. Mm-hmm. And we spoke about the show, how stress is a good thing. It's the lack of recovery that's a good thing. But stress actually brings out a piece of ourselves that we're on. Now, when you're training at this level, and I'm sure, now, Dubdovan from what I know, and all I know is from what I, you know, sort of know from the American sort of never been in the army, ever done anything. I think going to the gym for more than 45 minutes is military training. That's sort of my bar.
Right, right.
Sitting on the treadmill for 30 minutes, that's sort of like my bar of military training.
Mm-hmm.
So my knowledge of Duv Devon is that you guys are trained to literally dress up like Arabs to go into those territories to be in situations where you're literally behind enemy lines and you've got to be at every level, you know, sort of the best that you can be.
That's exactly it. But let me just, before we go on onto that tangent, let me clarify something. So I got a good amount of training in Duv Devon. I was there for about a year. I got Krav Maga training there in a place called Lotar, which is in Midkan Adam. For those listening to the radio show, those who know about it understand where I'm coming from. For those who don't, that's where the elite units of Israel train, and that's where they train specifically in hand-to-hand combat, urban combat, and things of that nature. So I was fortunate enough to get that far, but I wasn't operational with Duv Devon. I was operational in another unit called Oket, also called Kalbia. This is a specialized unit that trains dogs to find landmines, roadside bombs, etc. at that point in time in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So as a 19-year-old, you know, behind a machine gun in Lebanon looking for landmines with just a dog to save my life, that's also a fairly stressful situation, I think.
Right. So let's talk. I want to talk a little bit about that because that's something that I think a lot of our listeners deal with. All of us have stress in our lives, mm-hmm. and all of us are dealing with things,
mm-hmm.
right? And those things... Even though, you know, when you put it in the perspective of being in the middle of a minefield in Lebanon or being sort of on a elite training course and literally falling off as you carry stretchers back up and down hills. So in that context, like maybe my relationship or my life or my career or whatever I'm going through, my sickness, my injuries, you know, everyone has something that they're going through. And if it's not something that was given to them, something that they're trying to take on, you know, the relationship to the community, taking on greater responsibility, we all have stress.
Right.
How do you train? Because in hearing you, my head is thinking, you don't know how far your body can go, right? If you're up and down a hill, if you're training in a very intense environment, what you're really testing is your mind, right? You're really testing to see if your brain is going to give up. And how do you build that? What are you using personally to get through these very difficult training exercises where your brain is saying, you don't have to be here. Like, are you joking me? Like, go grab a soda and get in a cab and go home. You know what I'm saying? There's air conditioning in America.
Right,
like,
right,
you know, you can
right.
watch it on TV and pretend that you're involved. So what are you doing to enable you to grapple with
mm-hmm.
the stress and the mental anxiety that you're experiencing to get you through this training?
Okay, so it's funny. So now, years later, I can look back on that, and I can isolate two things specifically. One was what you actually spoke about in one of your audio programs. It's about wanting. So you have to want it. It has to be a good reason that you can intellectualize, internalize, and it has to make sense to you. You have to grab onto it and hold onto that. I'm here for reason X, Y, and Z, and it makes sense, and that's why I'm not going to stop. So in personal relationship, could be because, you know, you love your spouse, you love your children, and you want to do good by them, want to be a good example to them. The other thing is the philosophy of the Breslov Hasidim, you know, always be in simcha. And I have found, for example, the Masa Kumta, Masa is a long hike for the Kumtas, the beret. So the red beret is that's very prestigious. As a 20-year-old, I mean, you want that red beret. It's the equivalent of driving around in a Ferrari. So maybe it's not the most spiritual desire, but you want that red beret. I found that whenever we go on a long endurance event, like the Masa Kumta, which was 75 kilometers, there's units that do more than that, but 75 kilometers, that's about a double marathon. Go run a marathon and run back. And plus have weight on your, you know, carry stuff and carry your friends. And so it's, and wear combat boots, you know, and in shorts. And so when I found that I started happy and was going through this and was excited and happy, it takes away the pain.
But how are you happy? I mean, when you're going through it, and I'm even in pain thinking about what you're going through. I'm thinking
right.
to myself, as I'm even sitting here in my chair in this beautiful studio, I'm thinking to myself, like, I'm already exhausted thinking that you have to run so much. But when you're going through it and you're feeling that pain and every part of your body is saying, give up, give up. You're not going to make it. It's almost it's inhuman to think that you can push yourself this far. What are you using to say, I can?
Right. You have to latch on to something bigger than yourself. And at that point, it's your friends. You're there with your friends. You don't want to let them down. Mm-hmm. If you give up, they have to carry you. Mm-hmm. And that's more painful than the 75 kilometers or the 100 kilometers or, you know, the PhD program that you're going on. People are counting on you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more painful to let them down than to quit. And quitting is fairly painful. And along the way to reduce the pain, I mean, there's other methods. I mean, just be happy. I mean, sing. I mean, our sound technician here, he's a great singer. Don't know if you know about that.
Sure. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Rami's our man.
Let us mirror to the Shabbos tables of Rami. But, to be happy and just to know that other people are counting on you and your goal is bigger than yourself. I think that's the main way to get through painful situations.
So, I mean, just to sort of count it back for the listeners here. And everything in life, and just as I'm hearing you speak about it and picturing you running the double marathon with weight on your back and commando boots, but that really is for everybody in every area of their lives. We all deal with challenges, and what we're dealing with, I think, sometimes is not just a challenge like someone throws us a curveball. It could be that we have to go on a marathon, like we have to start down a road that we're just not happy to do, and it could be, like you said, like a PhD program, or it could be a job that we need to do, or work that we need to have, or a relationship, or whatever it is, or something that's spiritual, or trying to learn something. This is a big deal when it comes to spirituality. People are trying to grow, but it's hard to get to that next level. But what I'm hearing you say is what's happening sort of in the elite units, because it's something that people want to know. Like what you're doing is pushing yourself to a level that most of humanity doesn't push themselves physically, right? That's something that, whether it's in the Marine Corps, which we'll get to in a minute, or in the IDF, or in any basically army, but those are really the two greatest armies in the world today. From the perspective of taking a look at what you're doing and saying, okay, how do elite soldiers train mentally? Because whether or not I decide physically that it's important to me, I want to understand what you're doing mentally to get through your double marathon. And what I'm hearing you say, which is extremely powerful, is it's all about your mind, and it's all about your mindset and your mind frame. And now this stuff sounds soft, but it's really not, because people want it to. It's simple, you know. It's simplistic in its concept, but it's hard to apply, right? It's easy to hear, okay, be besimcha, but when you're running and you're in pain, you're like, I'm not besimcha. So it's a hard application, even though it's an easy understanding. And what I'm hearing you say is really three things, which is one, see the world bigger than yourself. Whether or not you're happy or sad or comfortable or in pain is less relevant to the mission that you're attaching yourself to. And that mission isn't just an army mission. That could be a Torah mission. Right. That could be a family mission. That could be anything that you're doing in life. You know, what amazes me the most, and not to digress here, but it's important, I look a lot at immigrants with a lot of respect. My dad's an immigrant. My grandparents are immigrants, and it's not just immigrants, but them in particular mean a lot to me, because usually when an immigrant comes to this country, they come with nothing, and they have to do things that are beneath them.
Mm-hmm.
They have to take jobs, and they have to do whatever it takes to make their lives for their family better. And what I find when I talk to immigrants, especially Holocaust surviving immigrants that didn't just sort of like pick up from one area and said, how? I heard I can make more money in America. Like disaster, destructive, terrible growing up in Europe. What I find from them is the ones that get through it with the positive attitude, they're very clear. I'm doing this for my family. There's a mission. I know I have to get up at 5 in the morning. I know I'm smarter than this. I know that I shouldn't be on my feet 20 hours a day. I'm doing this for my family. I'm doing this. There's a mission here. This isn't about me. And when those people have that mission, they get like a strength that's inside them that, you know, and that's, I think, what you're saying, which is this mission of I'm here for a reason. And also there are people counting on me. And that's an amazing thing you said a minute ago that I want to sort of delve in. It's profound. It hurts more to quit if people are going to rely on me than it is to go through a little bit more pain. And I think that's how armies train. Am I right? They train you like that.
Yeah, achdut is a very important thing. You have to be there for the team. When I do my training with when when I do group training now with teenagers, for example, at the end of every session, we say, Echad b'shul kulam, kulam b'shul echad. One for all for one.
Yeah.
That achdut is very important in everything that you do.
When you realize that people are counting on you, you know, there's a great piece, the Ramchal is one of the greatest, you know, philosophers and giants, Torah giants in the history of Judaism. He has a piece that I think is one of the most powerful pieces that I've ever read. It's in the third chapter of a sefer called Derech Hashem, in which he says that the way it really works in life is that God has a kingdom, and he divides the kingdom into all these little tasks, and he gives everybody one task. And if you don't do your task, we can't move forward. So every human being, if you're not doing your task, we don't move.
Mm-hmm.
And if we just all saw the world that way, I mean, if we just were able to focus outward and realize that people are counting on each other, it is just, we go through life differently. Now, let me jump in. How do you feel when you go through something like this and you realize that I didn't think I was going to make it? I thought I was going to die like 8 times and I made it. Is there this sense of euphoria that you feel when you're done training, when you're walking through a minefield and you have to use everything that you got and now you're done?
Sure. Okay. So let's clarify. Most people that take on big things, from my humble perspective, when they start out, if they're brave enough to think big or to think outside the bounds of what normal people think, they don't think they're going to fail. I'm going out on a limb and I'm going to say that. But once they're actually in the mud, trudging through and trying to get through it, that's when the doubts seep in. And, how much do you want it and be as happy as you can possibly be? I mean,
enjoy it the most.
Enjoy it. Very simply. Again, I want to make this applicable to all of our listeners. There was a point in time where all of us were single. And we were thinking, we were trying to find our Besheret, and that was huge. That was very important. So, last night, as I was trying to get some sleep to make sure I was lucid for the show, my kids, all of them, jumped into bed with us, me and my wife, and I could not sleep. And, at first I was kind of frustrated. And then I just stopped. I remembered back to my days of being single, and I told myself if I could go back to being single, back in time, and see this picture in the future, I'd be very, very happy.
Right.
And that helped me fall asleep.
I love it. So it's really a mental shift. It's being able to see where you are, appreciate it, and enjoy it.
Right.
So you come back from Israel, you're in college, you went to Columbia.
So, I was not a good student before I went to Israel. Israel had a tremendous shift on me because you come back, you do all these great things, you figure, hey, I can pretty much do anything. So very mediocre student in high school. Pretty much in the middle of the bell curve for everything. I got back from the Israeli military. I went to community college first. I aced all the classes. And then, again, I was brave enough to apply to Columbia. Mm-hmm. And I finished off the degree in Columbia.
Great. And now you're in Columbia, an amazing environment. And something compels you to join the Marine Corps now. What
right.
was that?
Right. So apparently I didn't have this bug out of me at the time, but certain people have a certain temperament. You know, you can be very intelligent in one thing, but your temperament leads you, or your soul leads you to another area. So this sort of thing is, whether I wanted to admit it or not, is something I just gravitated towards.
Mm-hmm.
And also wanted to serve both Israel and America.
Mm-hmm.
Dual citizen. You know, I have allegiance to both countries. I love both countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had an opportunity to come in as an officer. So that was the big allure for me.
So now you're a U.S. Marine. And you're being trained as a U.S. Marine in also martial arts training. They put you through commando training there too, and you're doing your thing?
No, it's not commando training per se. The Marines, we hold ourselves up to be, you know, better than all the other branches of the military.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't call it specifically commando training. It's more than other branches, but I wouldn't call it commando. But it was officer training,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, also very demanding by design.
Right. And now you're a Marine for how many years?
I was 4 years in the Marine Corps.
4 year Marine Corps, and from what I understand, at some point they had to ask you, you know, pick a side, right? Like if we're gonna get to a place where there's ever a time where the U.S. attacks Israel, you got to pick one or the other, and you're like, I can't. And that was sort of the end. Is that sort of how it plays out?
Yeah, this is something not really, not a whole lot of people know about me. Yes, so this is post 9/11. 9/11, I remember seeing the Twin Towers. I was in Corpus Christi at the time. I was actually in flight school.
What's Corpus Christi for our listeners?
Corpus Christi is a small town in Texas, and they have a naval air station where the Marines and Navy, amongst other things, have a school for training pilots. So I was in their pilot program for a while. And on 9/11, that was going to be my first solo flight. So before going out to the plane and taxiing out to the runway, the TV was on, and we saw the Twin Towers burning, hit by the first plane. Mm-hmm. And I looked up, and there was another pilot there, and or student pilot, and I asked her, was it on purpose? And she looked at me and she laughed. The idea of someone on purpose taking a plane and ramming it into the Twin Towers, it was just, in the United States at the time, it was just outside of the bounds of logic. Who would do that? Nobody would do that.
Right.
And so by the time I taxied out to the runway, I lined up straight. I was ready to throttle the plane to take off my first solo flight. I was called back. I was called back into the building, and I thought, oh, gosh, what did I do now? And that was the exact moment that all the airports in the United States were closed down. Mm-hmm. Also a first in history. So, and but anyway, that's Corpus Christi. That's where going down memory lane like this. Okay, after 9/11, after the Twin Towers, I didn't make it through flight school. I tried very hard. Some things God says not for you.
Right.
You try as hard as you want, not for you.
Right.
So every time I get into the plane, I just couldn't stop throwing up.
Oy.
That was a physical, right. Physical thing that I just couldn't mentally overcome.
Well, it's nauseating. You're not flying on an American Airlines flight in the back. You know what
right.
I'm saying? This isn't the usual commercial flight.
Right, right. So from there, I segued. I was an amphibious assault vehicle officer. That was my new MOS, mm-hmm. military occupational specialty. And I was already a first lieutenant. And it took a little bit of time, but eventually somebody found out that, hey, this guy served in the Israeli military before coming into the Marine Corps, which was fine in the beginning. No, everybody thought he was great. But post 9/11, there was a bit of paranoia going on. Mm-hmm. So there was an investigation into me, and it went on for months and months and months. And eventually they asked the question they should have asked me in the beginning. If the U.S. should go to war with Israel, which I still think is near impossibility, but if the U.S. should ever go to war with Israel, would you attack Israel? I'm not a good liar. I'm a terrible liar. And on something as emotional as that, yes, I'm not intelligent enough to be a good liar. You have to remember everything you say. But I immediately said, no, of course not. I wouldn't do that. And that was all she wrote. And
that was it.
They took away my security clearance. So I couldn't go to war in Iraq, and I was stuck training, stuck. It was still a privilege, but I was training Marines coming out of boot camp in the military occupational specialty of being an amphibious assault crewman. Mm-hmm. So those Marines went right to Iraq after I trained them.
Mm-hmm. And in your training, so this first of all is an amazing thing that you're able to sort of, say that thing and take that stand, which is something that I think many of us in our own lives need to sort of figure out, which is this is something that I see a lot from people that are achieving great things in life. Is that they're clear with their values. No, the answer is no. This is something that I get a lot when people are taking certain things on in their lives, religious or otherwise, and they go places and they're like, can you? And I'm like, no, I just can't. And like, I know, but come on, it's just an email. You can't check it. It's only Saturday afternoon. No, I just can't. And the ability for us to sort of set the line in our values and say, this is what I do. This is where I am. Like, I am with my family now. I am with God now. I am praying. I'm really off. It's 25 hours. I know it's a long time. If you got, I'm sorry if it bothers you, but I'm off. But our ability to set values for who we are, is what makes who we are. And you see people out there, that have no strength on their values. They're always sort of adapting and saying like, well, I mean, I could, and there's a lack of integrity. I remember when I got to the workforce, I went through a little bit different path than you, a lot different path. I went to, like, you know, the lawyer path. We learned how to lie. They taught us that in law school, so that's okay. So I can give you tips later. You teach me self-defense, I'll teach you lying. It's a great deal. So I remember when I was there and I got to my first job, it was that same problem, that there's this pressure of, like, you can't really be that orthodox. Like, it's, you're going to stand out. And the one person he opened to me, I'll never forget, he was a Catholic guy. He said, listen, he goes, if you stand up for yourself, he goes, we'll all respect you. Like, that was a question for me, but he's like, just stand up. We're all going to respect you. He's like, people respect people with values. And it must have been really hard, and you taking that stance, I guess, was an amazing move for you. And it really says a lot about who you are and your value system. And I sort of want to continue moving here, which is sort of the training, right? Mm-hmm. I'm getting right back to those same points, because this is sort of what fascinates me. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get an inside look at military trainers and military training and see if we can apply it to our lives. So how are you training those guys to be in these scenarios, to be in these environments that are so physically demanding, that are so not normal, that are so stressful? What is going on in hand-to-hand combat and how you train people? And I'm sure now how you use it now, we'll get to that in a minute in terms of what you're doing now with Krav Maga. But still back in the military, and for those that are tuning in, we're sitting here with Alon Evan Esh, who is a former commando and military officer in both the U.S. and the Israeli militaries. We're talking about self-defense, talking about physical training, mental toughness. We're talking about sort of how to sort of get it all together. So what are some of the tricks, some of the tips, some of the things that you're doing sort of behind these lines and these compounds that are training, you know, sort of top-level soldiers that are going to deal with stress, that are going to deal with physical and emotional pain and mostly uncertainty to prepare them?
Right, right. Singleness of purpose is really, thinking back, I mean, considering both militaries, thinking back, I think singleness of purpose was the main thing. Probably the most intense, if you want to break it down, between the Israeli military and the U.S. Marine Corps. I didn't go through the a full MCMAP, Marine Corps Martial Arts program, getting a black belt over there, but I understand it's very demanding. But in the Israeli military, going through Lotar, where they learn Krav Maga, amongst other things, the singleness of purpose is the main thing. It's not how pretty you look as you do a certain technique, but do it aggressively. Do it 100%. Execute it as aggressively as you can. And I don't know if this is the correct philosophy all the time, especially outside the military, but they taught us a bit of a tunnel vision. That's your target. Go get your target. And even if you get hit along the way, shot along the way, you can still run. You can still do it.
Mm-hmm. And I love this. I love this. I love this. The tunnel, right? Mm-hmm. When you say singleness of purpose, is what you're saying, be fully present, right? You are all at the target. You're not thinking, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Oh my gosh, oh my God, he's doing what? Oh my God. You're not overwhelmed with everything going wrong. And you're not thinking, oh my God, do I got to get back to my friend next week? Like, oh my God, wait, hold on. I think my BlackBerry is buzzing. Give me a second before you punch me. Just give me 1 second. Yeah. Because you are 1,000,000% focused on not even 10 steps, right? And I wanted to ask about that, because the myth is that, like, you can see 10 steps ahead. Or you can just see what's right in front of you. And the goal is to say, whatever I'm doing it 1,000,000%. If I'm throwing a non-perfect technique punch,
right,
it's going to be the best non-focused technique punch I ever have inside me, because I'm going to do whatever I do at 1,000%. And all I'm thinking about is the tunnel in front of me. And is that how you train people in sort of how to deal with this stuff?
Okay. So it got to be clear. So military training, in Israel, I was not an officer. In the Marine Corps, I was. It's a very different perspective. As an officer, you want to look at the whole entirety of the situation, and you want to plan, and you want to make sure that you have plan A, plan B, plan C, because as the saying goes, you know, plan A falls apart as soon as bullets go downrange, And in the martial arts world, they say you punch a black belt enough times in the face, he becomes a white belt. So, and it's true. And it's true. I mean, the best people get razzled sometimes. So, singleness of purpose is good, I would say, for small tasks. But on a bigger picture, let's say, I mean, if you have, you know, CEOs or whoever listening to this, or people who need to plan out a large operation, they need to take the whole thing into account. Mm-hmm. And give tasks to their people to execute single-mindedly.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's definitely, you know, needs for plan. Where I'm getting at here is where I think most of us fail, myself included, is once we're planned and now we're in it, we're never fully in it. Like, once I realize that time home with my kids is important and that I'm home with them, I'm never really home with them. Once I realize that praying to the creator of the universe is a really good idea, and I'm wrapped and I'm ready to roll, I'm never there, because I'm always everywhere.
Right.
And I think tunnel vision is maybe the most important thing we can have during the day, because most of us are overthinking and overrunning and never fully punching, you know, punching the world with aggression. We're not there. We're not fully invested. And I'm hearing you, and I just want to make sure I'm hearing it correctly, is that when you're talking about a military scenario, which is just an example of a high-pressured scenario that's life and death,
right,
and when you're talking about it from a larger perspective like training, or from a more myopic perspective, which is even a martial arts match, mm-hmm. what I'm hearing you say is that the training – now, this is something you just tell a guy and he gets it, right? But the training mentally is, we need to teach you how to be in that moment and how to be fully invested, single-minded purpose, tunnel vision, whatever you got, you got, you throw, you give 1,000%.
I would say that's 100% accurate. Yeah.
And that idea is so powerful. And hearing it from you and taking it from you, from where you're coming from, to me is like totally motivating, because you're at the lines of, and I'm not downplaying emotional, mental, and spiritual pursuits, but it's clear to everybody that being in a situation where you're training people or dealing with things that are life and death brings out the best and the worst in people. Like you said, you get hit enough times, you become a white belt. And that to me is an amazing thing. Let's jump into Krav Maga.
Sure.
So what is Krav Maga?
Okay, it's it's an Israeli form of hand-to-hand combat that was developed by the Israeli military, and later on it was taken out of that military context and civilianized for day-to-day assaults out in the streets and people's daily lives. To really simplify it, I would say it's probably the world's first form of mixed martial arts, because you take from many different disciplines, boxing, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, and others, and you combine what works the best, and you throw away everything else, and you try to make it as natural to the student as possible. What do I mean by that? Krav Maga has a big emphasis on taking a person's natural reaction to stimulus. For example, they get scared, or someone goes to hit them in an overhand motion. What is your natural reaction? And it's to put your hands up. Mm-hmm. So take that natural reaction, modify it slightly to be an effective defense and counterattack, be aggressive while you do it, and then drill that until it's just muscle memory. And it's a very simple form of self-defense and very easy to learn.
So you're teaching this now around the country, right? You have people around the city and the country all. And are you finding an uptick in the desire to learn Krav Maga? I mean, I personally haven't heard of it 2 years ago. And I must have gotten invitations to a half a dozen sort of Krav Maga trainings now in shuls and schools and JCCs, and like everywhere you look, people are talking about Krav Maga. So are you finding that there's this like need that's coming through now for the first time, you know, at least in an American, I guess in an Israeli community, an Israeli, you know, that's one thing. But I'm talking about an American Jewish community finding now that, or even just an American community, I'm not just Jewish, but
right.
you find that there's like an interest for learning this stuff, for defending oneself?
Well, I think, yeah, in the Jewish community there, I mean, martial arts has been around, prior. It was never something, big, but, you know, in YU, there was, developed a Torah dojo. Many people that I meet, know of that, heard of that, and that was the first introduction to sort of a frum form of martial arts. So I think lately, maybe the knockout game and certain things of that nature have brought about a greater awareness of it. But in general, the frum community is seriously lacking in this one aspect of personal development, mm-hmm. I think.
Of self-defense, of skill.
Most physical activities in general, self-defense in particular. Yes.
Right. That was a very, right. Most, right. There is a lack of sort of physical focus. I think that, yeah, there's definitely a sense that, you know, physicality is not considered, you know, high enough on the scale. Although that's coming back too now. I'm finding that more and more people that I speak to are saying that how you take your health and what you do and what you eat and how you train is really important. And I mean, that's something that I think is really important as we sort of, I guess, march our way to Geula that way. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, training and what you do to get somebody mentally and physically prepared. So does Krav Maga require a certain physical stance? Like, do you have to be athletic, or is it sort of a mental approach towards, you see a target now, don't run, sort of turn around, face it. If you see that challenge in front of you, now let me teach you, because it's even listening to you and how you describe Krav Maga, that is literally how people approach everything, or should approach everything in life, right? Like, in every challenge, the way to approach it is take the best of everything that works, put it together, and then train yourself enough times so you have muscle memory, right? Like, right. That's a little bit of what we're trying, like, even in relationships, like, figure out what works, right? And then train yourself to not respond in the way that's constantly going to leave the world littered with all the damage that you've caused. And what you're just doing, what you're saying is that's what's happening from a self-defense martial arts perspective. So, when you're training people, and you said a minute ago that it wasn't that difficult in terms of somebody getting it, it's built to be natural. So what are you, if you can just sort of, I mean, can you give us a sort of that first lesson? I mean, we're on the radio, so you can't really teach to me, but like,
right.
What's that first thing you tell people that, get, and by the way, you know, Elon's available. We're going to give out his information on my website, and on Facebook and Twitter. I'm going to tweet out all of Elon's information in case you want to hire him or bring him on to do classes. And of course, I know that you're doing one in Woodmere, right? You're doing a class.
Yeah.
So hopefully let's see if I can join that. If not, maybe, you know, we'll talk about something else, because I'd love to learn this as well. But, you know, we'll send around your information so that people that are interested on the call to can get you and access your talents. What's that
Thank
first
you.
Thing that you teach people when you see them and getting them ready to like learn self-defense?
Okay, so this is a little bit not related to Krav Maga. I tend to teach more individuals and small groups. Mm-hmm. When I teach individuals and small groups, individuals especially, everybody has a different personal history. Some were bullied growing up, others weren't. Some we had much worse things done to them. Some have a history of mugging. Others. I can go on and on. Everybody has a different personal background. Everybody has a different temperament. There's some, for example, children. I haven't met an adult yet, but there's some children that I will make an assessment and say, this child, I will not teach how to hit. I will teach something else. And when they're mature enough, I will turn that game that I'm teaching this child to develop his self-confidence and his coordination. I'll take that game, if the child is still studying with me, and I'll make a switch, and all of a sudden those games become real self-defense techniques mm-hmm. that the child never knew that person had. So everybody is different. Everybody has a different set of needs. So first I have a conversation, and after the conversation, I go to where the person takes me. Most people had some sort of confrontation in their life. I like to go towards that confrontation. If that confrontation was with a weapon, we learn weapon defense first. If that confrontation was hand to hand, a fist, a foot, a headlock, whatever it was, we go there first. We recreate and deconstruct that situation, mm-hmm. and we go from there. And then we build upon that.
And everything right now is defense, right? You're not teaching people to fight. And that's something that I think could be a criticism, which I'm assuming
yes.
is not, is that people would say, oh, you're teaching people how to fight. The last thing we need is a bunch of people walking around like beating each other up.
Right.
This is not that, right? You're saying this is sort of a – I mean, ultimately, you may have to, but this
right.
is this is almost entirely a – defense mechanism. This is a way to sort of defend yourself against, you know, potential
sure.
threats.
Yes. Krav Maga is not a sport. There are no rules in Krav Maga. You can do some very nasty things in Krav Maga that will take an attempt to turn it into a sport and make a person's career in it very short-lived. Krav Maga is not a sport. It's a no-rule kind of scenario. And especially with children, the emphasis is on defense. When you get to higher levels of training, you can't have defense without offense. That's just a fact. That's something you can't hide, at the higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm teaching a child, I can teach a child to defend themselves without hitting. Yes, I can do that and do it effectively. But at the higher levels, if you're training an adult, there is no defense without offense. That's why, you know, Tzahal, Tzava Haganah L'Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces,
yeah.
has a lot of offensive capability.
Right.
So to defend, you need that offensive capability.
Now, how long does it take somebody to sort of get this? If someone's doing training with you, how long does it take for them to be able to defend themselves?
It depends on the person, but I've seen results with, you know, kids as young as 9 after one lesson. And, of course, that child's problem is just like a 9-year-old bully, which is different than, let's say, an adult male attacking another adult male.
Right.
Or even an adult male attacking a woman, or adult male attacking a child, which we also deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most basics, I mean, I've had somebody have or learn enough competence after one lesson. It's not unheard of.
And what happens to their self-confidence? Do you find that after learning a couple of these techniques, you know, even if they never use it, or they use it very rarely. I mean, and to think that, I mean, it hurts to think that there are people that are living in scenarios right now that need self-defense to people around them, like an adult or a bully. And I mean, it's the reality in which we live in. It's just hard to even hear it. That kid that you've taught, right, or that person, do you find that as soon as they get these skills, their whole sort of, you know, energy, their essence sort of shifts. They walk around with a different confidence. They're not victims anymore. They can take care of themselves.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I wish I had some of my students, mothers here too, and fathers to vouch for that. I've seen it, and not just in. I mean, yes. Yeah. The simple answer is yes. It's like getting the answers to a test, and the answers are the right answers because they work.
Yeah. Give me an example, if you can, without using any names, obviously, of a kid whose whole, you know, what happened to him after.
Okay, I'll give you the worst situation that I've dealt with, and I've heard a number of cases. It was a sexual abuse case of a child. And by the way, let me just briefly stop here and say this is a problem in all communities, but in our community, what worsens this problem is that we tend to try to take care of it by ourselves and keep it quiet. And I think sexual abuse, especially on children, you got to go to some sort of authority, be it the police or somebody that will take action. But again, so in this case of a child that was sexually abused for a long time before the parents actually found out who did it and stopped it, I taught this child a number of techniques. And from the first lesson, during the first lesson, the child was looking at me, smiling, running back to the mother who was observing, giving her a hug as if to say thank you, because these are situations and these are the answers to the situations. And so literally the nightmares stop. And just before we segue, this child, to make things even worse, there were bullying situations on top of this, as if this child needed this. So during the bully situations, as normal, the bully was older and bigger. And this happened twice. And this child was able to defend against the bully very effectively, mm-hmm. to the point that I was actually scared, because when I was training this child due to the sexual abuse situation, I was teaching the child to defend against an adult. So they put this against a child, I was actually worried. But thank God everything was okay, and now this child is not bullied anymore, in addition to not having nightmares.
So now this child is now able to defend himself in these situations, which is an amazing thing. I mean, just to just talk about bullying, which is a whole topic into itself as to what's happening and how people are now. I mean, there's always been built bullying. I don't think there was, you know, I mean, there was bullying when I was in high school and bullying when I was in elementary school. Like, I don't think you got on a bus in seventh grade and it was like all the boys were like sitting in front, like, oh, wow, you know, can I borrow your gum? Like, and now all of a sudden, like, now everyone's beating each other up. I think we were always, but I think now, like in a lot of things in life, people are paying attention and it's getting to a point where it may be even exacerbating with other things. Well, what about somebody who is not in an abusive situation, where somebody's sort of in a regular, healthy environment? Is this something that benefits them? That just to know and to grow and to use it even as a tool to get physically stronger and even mentally stronger?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the base case scenario. You have somebody healthy doing something that they like. A nice thing about Krav Maga, it's not just working out. It's not like getting on the treadmill or strapping yourself into a machine or even, you know, getting under the squat rack. It's a skill. It's a skill that you can develop and learn, and it's a skill that you can also use to get better in a cardiovascular fashion or a muscular development fashion or flexibility, and it keeps you healthy or healthier longer, so you can be there for the people that count on you, like your children and your wife, your spouse, your friends, your community. And yes, when we train to a point of fatigue, and then we go beyond that point of fatigue when the time is right. You can't push it with your everyday person.
Right.
But when the time is right, you get to that point of fatigue and you give that gentle nudge. Say, look, you can do more. Did you see that? You didn't think you could, but you did.
Right.
Congratulations.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. And I know that I got a lot and I'm sure everyone else got a lot. And for those that want to, do you have a website, by the way?
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm not the best, in websites, but it's called Shomer360.com, S-H-O-M-E-R, the number 360.com.
Perfect. Shomer360.com, and we're going to put it on Facebook, Charlie Harari, Twitter, and we're going to send this around. And so, Ilan, thank you so much for joining us, and it was
pleasure,
an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So I just want to sort of wrap up a little bit here, and I was blown away. A couple of things just to go through and to, you know, sort of capture from some of the conversations that were there. And even just the thing that he said a minute ago that just sort of struck me, which is when he trains people, he pushes you to fatigue and then he goes a little bit further than that. And I think that's sort of such a nice sort of example and lesson for life, which is that there's so much that we have inside us. And this is something that you know, I speak to people a lot about and I try to think about a lot. I mean, for myself, and we have so much more inside us than we think. What we think we have is much less than what we actually have, right? We are given a car that can go 150 and we're going like 30 and being like, I don't know. I think if I go a little further, the steering wheel is going to shake. Like, it's amazing what was given to us. It's amazing what we have. It's mind boggling what our body can do, what our mind can do, what our soul can accomplish, no matter where you are. That's just the reality. And when you speak to somebody, like we spoke to today, that went through these high-level intensive trainings that for the most of us, at least I know for me, we would never make it. Like, who's running up and down a hill in like 100 degrees carrying sandbags if they don't have to? Like, unless like you're punished, like why would you do that for? But when you have a belief in a larger mission, whatever mission that is, and when you realize that you're part of a community and people are counting on you, and when you have this certain stance where the pain that you feel isn't as terrible as it may feel because there's good there and you open with happy. That's what he told us, right? You were with me today, right? It's your mission. It's you being happy and it's you recognizing that you're part of something bigger than yourself. You're part of a community. When you have this stance in everything you do in life, what you find is the power to go past what you thought possible. Greatness is the space that's past what you thought possible. I thought I can go this far. I am further than that. Once you hit that zone, you're entering into your greatness, and it doesn't necessarily mean the same for my greatness, because ultimately, greatness is personal to my own personal development. When I push to fatigue, I love that. That was great what he said at the end. I push them to fatigue, and then I go further. because that's what greatness is. That's where it lies. That's the zone. That's the area of greatness. It only exists when you're able to go to the point of fatigue and then further, because fatigue is where you got yesterday. Fatigue is where your body's like, I'm done. But when you're able to push, you realize like, oh my God, I really wasn't done. There was more to go. Now, how do we do that? Now, this, by the way, to me in the interview really was a shift for me, because I'm always curious about, like, you know, trainings and self-defense. These are areas that I don't know about. I mean, I never had this background, and I'm always wondering, like, what's going on over there mentally? I mean, physically, we can see things, hear things, read things. What's going on mentally? And what two of the things that came out that I thought was so profound was this idea of single-mindedness. Single-mindedness, the singular purpose. I've got a focus, and I'm only thinking about that focus. Now, you got a plan, but when you're in it, you're in it. And we did this last year's halftime show. We did a show with Yeshiva University, and that was sort of the idea that I gave over, which is, if you notice in the Super Bowl, no players, whether they're on the sidelines or on the field, are going to be checking their iPhones. This is not even going to, like, you kidding me? Like, no one's, like, worrying about what's going to happen, like, in 2 weeks from now. Nobody is, like, worrying about checking to make sure that Facebook or whatever they're doing, because you can't play at the level of Super Bowl and not be fully invested in what you do. You just can't. You can't. You can't be a good parent and not be fully invested in your children. That's not how it works. You can't be a good spouse and not be fully invested in your spouse or in your job or in your God or your whatever you're doing. You can't. Your ability to be fully invested is where greatness happens. Now, this is a great piece that he said earlier that I loved, which is what they train you in is if you're throwing a non-good technique punch, if that's what you got, if all you got is a punch that someone would be like, that's his punch, like, all right, whatever, you got to throw it 1,000%. That's where a lot of us get tripped up. We think that if we're not techniqued enough, if I'm not good enough, if I don't have it down, what am I going all in for? But it's the opposite. Going all in is saying whatever I've got to do 1,000%. If I'm punching, theoretically, of course, or not necessarily theoretically, but theoretically, if I'm punching, even if it's not a good punch, it's going to be all of me in that punch. That's training. That's being great. It's going to the world today with everything you got and saying, I may not be perfect, I may not be the best, but whatever I got, I'm here and I'm going to go 1,000%. Because that's what it is. And that last piece, which is the ability to be in defense, I think that's so important. To defend yourself. To not run. To not be a victim. To learn the skills, whether those are emotional, mental, or physical skills. If somebody's abusing you, to learn the skills to defend yourself, to not have to rely. Now, I'm not saying it's always so simple, and I'm not trying to be Pollyannish, but in general, there's so much of our lives that we're able to control. And when we see ourselves in that capacity, we get stronger, we get bigger, we become greater. That's what life's about. Not being good or great, but being awesome. Taking responsibility. Being the person we're meant to be. Special thanks to our executive producer, God. This is Charlie Harari telling you to live your life in the book of life. We'll see you next week. Kind of nervous that we're almost there. At the days of all.